Welcome to Acute Leukemia Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Daniel D'Angelo from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
She's a 21-year-old junior at Georgetown, was home for Easter vacation, had just had some dental work done prior to returning for the Easter break, and really wasn't healing properly, was still having a lot of gum bleeding. Went back and forth to her dentist and tried some antibiotics. And then finally, the dentist said, you know, this is not healing the way I would expect it. I think you need to get a blood count. I'm worried. And she went to the local emergency room and got a blood count that showed a high white count of about 85,000. She was anemic with a hemoglobin of 10.3 and thrombocytopenic platelet count of 17,000, which was obviously the reason why she was bleeding after the procedure. And then on review later on that evening, she was called back in because she had circulating blasts and then immediately transferred from the local small hospital into our facility where a bone marrow examination was performed showing a replacement of her marrow with small immature cells, blast forms specifically, that by flow cytometric analysis showed that they were expressing only the B cell antigens. In her case, they were positive for 1019 DR and TDT. So relatively easy diagnosis, and she had acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Cytogenetics came back a few weeks later, showing that she had a normal 46XX, but there was a derivative 119, which is not an uncommon adverse, usually, marker, E2A PBX1. Importantly, what was gotten back in about 48 hours was the fact that her Philadelphia chromosome was negative, at least by PCR, confirmed later by cytogenetics. And that's very important in terms of bifurcating patients, all patients, between Philadelphia positive ALL and Philadelphia negative ALL. So we have here a young woman, 21 years of age, with a Philadelphia negative B cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia. And of course, the first question is, what's the best approach to care for this patient? If she were 3 or 4 years younger, she'd be treated in a pediatric or children's hospital, put on a pediatric trial, and if she were 10 to 15 years older, she'd be receiving more of an adult regimen. This is kind of a gray zone, a much talked about gray zone in terms of what do we do with these young adult patients. There's clearly a marked improvement in the outcomes of patients over the last decade, 2 decades in pediatric patients in terms of the survival. Nowadays, 95 to 98% of pediatric patients can go into remission, and about 85%, maybe a little higher, can be cured of their disease. But in adult patients defined as 18 and over, this is lacking. And historically, what we've seen over the last several decades is about 45 to 50% of these patients being cured. Well, since 2000, there's been an exploration of how to best treat these young adult patients. And one of the approaches has been to treat a young adult patient like the example I'm giving you here, a 21-year-old with a pediatric regimen. And this is, in fact, what we chose to do. So there's a push to try and break away from what we, or what I at least, was taught during my hem-onc fellowship in terms of focusing all patients receive the same therapy. We reserve our young patients to really think about the advantages and the discipline of our pediatric leukemia mavens, and we've adapted the pediatric protocols to this young adult patient population. And that's the approach, at least in my institution, that we take for patients under age 40.
And so I was going to ask you in terms of what age, when you make that determination, how much of it is sort of the basic, you know, performance and organ function of the host as opposed to the biology of the disease?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and that's very important. There are two issues, obviously, that you raised. One is the biology, and I think what we've learned from doing these prospective trials of looking at pediatric or pediatric-like trials into these young adult patients is that the biology is roughly the same. We're learning some differences now, but the biology is roughly the same. There are some significant issues as patients get older in terms of their ability to tolerate the intensive chemotherapy that these pediatric trials deliver. And a lot of that has to do with the health of the liver and other organs that really metabolize the chemotherapy. And so those are some of the things that we'll use to make the adjudication whether or not this patient's appropriate for a pediatric or a pediatric-like regimen versus to try a less intensive regimen. But we think that most of the patients have a very similar biology as to their pediatric counterparts, and only the older patients do we see a major change. Of course, that's a very generalized statement, and it's not exactly true.
So I'd like you to go through some of the science that underlies these questions, but I am curious what happened with this patient.
So she's actually one of the success stories for our pediatric trial. So she was seen about 8 years ago. She went back and graduated from Georgetown, got a job, and is engaged to be married and doing remarkably well. She's now 8 years out. The E2A PBX1 translocation historically has been a poorer prognostic sign, which really has been abrogated with newer intensive therapy. So we're very pleased not only with her outcome, but also the outcome of many patients like her. But to get to your question, the way we separate the biology, first of all, as I alluded to at the beginning, is Philadelphia positive or Philadelphia negative. That's a very, very important thing. And at least my approach is I usually will just administer some corticosteroids to what I call cool the patient off. It usually takes about 48 to 72 hours to get that data back before I'll initiate a protocol or a therapy for that patient. It's so important to know whether the Philadelphia chromosome is present. In kids, it's only present about 2 to 3% of the time. In adults, about 30% of the time. But it's a linear migration. So in young adult patients, 20s to 30s, we see in about 5 to 6%, and it keeps increasing in frequency to patients over age 60, about half of them. So in this young woman, she was Philadelphia negative, and so that really bifurcates our decision. There is a new entity that's coming out. We don't know exactly how to identify those patients perfectly. It's called a Philadelphia-like signature. So it looks like, smells like, biologically like the Philadelphia chromosome. I know I keep using the word like there, but it is the name of the disease. But it doesn't have a Philadelphia chromosome. These patients are thought to have a poorer prognosis, and there is a slight increase in the frequency in this AYA or young adult patient population. I raise that as an issue because that's the new 2017 biologic issue. We're not exactly sure how to treat those patients any differently, and at least at my institution, we just watch them more closely, but we treat them with the same studies.
One other question before we kind of get more into this is, in what situations, if any, do you see a general medical oncologist in community-based practice managing a patient with ALL, either from beginning to end or maybe in conjunction with a tertiary center?
ALL is a two-year-long process. And so the decision tree is, how sick is the patient? Can the patient get into a tertiary center? Many times they can't. And then as you do this disease stratification based on risk factors, what I mean is genetic risk factors, is the patient going to need a transplant or not? And obviously transplants are being done in the community. But a large percentage of patients, especially patients in this 18 to 40-year-old range, have standard risk ALL. And data from our institution as well as data from other institutions suggests that they do not need a transplant. So oftentimes what I'll do is I'll co-share, co-manage these patients because they have to live. These are adult patients. They have to work. They're often married. They may have kids. And so there needs to be some type of co-management or co-sharing of the patient. So oftentimes what we'll do is we'll either discuss it by phone if the patient can't come to initiate a regimen, or the induction therapy will be initiated in my institution. And then the complicated consolidation will be done at our institution. But a lot of the more standard therapies, including the maintenance, which goes on for about a year and a half, can be easily done in the community. And there's this management, co-sharing. It really just takes communication, but it's clearly an effort that can be done and accomplished. The classification of acute lymphoblastic leukemia has been simplified over the years, and we used to go through all these different subtypes, but really the thrust is it's either B-cell or T-cell acute lymphoblastic leukemia. We usually think that the T cells did worse, but they actually don't. They just have a slightly different relapse pattern. And the outcomes with modern therapy are very identical. What's taken out of this classification and is classified into a different group are those with Burkitt's leukemia. Now, that's a rare disease. Burkitt's typically presents as a lymphoma, but about 5% of ALL used to historically be, when, at least when I was in med school, classified under this classification of acute lymphoblastic leukemia. It's very important to differentiate Burkitt's leukemia as a different entity because they don't behave the same. their expectations for outcome are very different if they're treated on a standard ALL therapy as opposed to Burkitt's protocol. So this has just been simplified. And then to remind you that there is a bimodal distribution of acute lymphoblastic leukemia, clearly the most common blood cancer, if you will, in children, second most common cancer behind brain tumors, but it is the bread and butter of our pediatric colleagues. But in the adult world, it's the least common leukemia. You do see a slightly higher increase in the incidence as you get older, but it dwarfs in comparison to chronic lymphoid, chronic myeloid leukemias, and even its acute counterpoint, acute myeloid leukemia. And so it's so important that I spend a couple days really sorting out whether a patient is Philadelphia positive or negative, because I'm going to initiate different therapeutic backbones depending on the age of the patient. And pediatric-inspired studies have a lot of hepatotoxins, so if a patient is Philadelphia positive, I'm less likely to use a pediatric-inspired regimen with a tyrosine kinase inhibitor like dasatinib. For adult regimens or low-intensity regimens with my very older patients, over 60, then it's important to know whether there's a Philadelphia chromosome, because I'm going to start the tyrosine kinase inhibitor sometimes just with steroids in the very older or with some modified therapy. In the younger patient population who are Philadelphia negative, as I've alluded to, these are the patients that we treat with pediatric or pediatric-inspired therapies. It's more intense, a lot more complicated. The data on when does a patient become an adult, I mean, we know that. I mean, those of you who are parents know that very clearly. Independent decision-making, financial independence, mature systems, the host becomes an adult at a defined time, but the biology doesn't necessarily follow. The point I'm trying to bring here is that a 17-year-old with acute lymphoblastic leukemia is defined and allocated to a pediatric or children's hospital, but the biology of his or her disease is not that dissimilar to a 21-year-old that has been historically treated on adult regimens. And so this bifurcation, this splitting of patients just simply based on whether they're under 18, over 18, is extremely arbitrary because the biology doesn't work that way. It's more similar than not. And so Dr. Stock from the University of Chicago looked at the cancer and leukemia group B, which is a cooperative group trial compared to the children's cancer group. Now, neither of these cooperative groups exist today. They've been morphed into others. But what she had observed was when she looked at patients 16 to 19, either treated on CLGB trials or CCG trials, she noticed that although the remissions were the same, the patients got into remission about 95, 98% of the time, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to show that my patient would be better served if he or she were treated on the pediatric study as opposed to the adult study, which was very disturbing for those of us who are adults because these patients have historically been treated on adult regimens. And this wasn't the only study. There were studies done throughout Europe that recapitulated this observation. So the data, these are studies from just representative pediatric studies showing the really wonderful outcomes that could always be better, but wonderful outcomes with the advent of chemotherapy following on the initiation of Sidney Farber all the way through with combination chemotherapy. Decisions are being made in terms of randomizations to use different steroid preparations, different asparaginase preparations. In the adult world, you just have to pick because it's very hard to do randomized studies. So what we did at our institution is we took a pediatric regimen. We were lucky we picked the better choices, so to speak, the steroid arm with dexamethasone, the individualized dosing, and just extrapolated that into our adult patients. And we were able to generate some really profound responses in terms of overall survival in the 70% range.
This may seem like a naive question, but looking back historically, I remember in medical school, you know, first hearing about this, it always kind of seemed to me that, I mean, it was incredible, the results that we're seeing with pediatric ALL, but it kind of seemed a little bit like a kitchen sink type approach, that you're just like throwing everything you could pop. Is there any way, and in your own mind, what is the real essence of why these patients get cured? Is it just this cumulative cytotoxicity from all these different approaches, or is there anything more intuitive than that?
That's a very good point. You know, it's a buildup of history, really. So the steroid backbone, which is very important for acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and then things were added sequentially. Well, what if we add this drug? Well, that worked better than not adding it. Well, let's add another drug and then another drug. Sidney Farber back in the 40s and 50s used single agent therapy, and he was able to see some responses to the chemotherapy. but it was that push, that desire to get more kids into remission, that they went from using single drugs one at a time to using multi-agent chemotherapy. And that really was revolutionary. It sounds trivial right now, 2017, but 50 years ago it was revolutionary because now for the first time you're able to get a large amount of kids into remission. And then kids were still relapsing, first in the central nervous system. So in the 60s, they were central nervous system prophylaxis. And then this idea that you only kill dividing cells with chemotherapy. So if you give an induction regimen up front, and then you hit back with another induction regimen several months later, you can get those cells that were not killed initially. And that's called reinduction or late intensification. Each one of these steps dramatically improved the outcome by about 20 points. It's now very hard in the current studies to now go back and remove certain agents. But you're absolutely right. The kitchen sink has been thrown at these kids, and it's hard to know exactly which drug in which stage is most important. But at least with very, very good prognostic children, ages 2 to 10, these experimental protocols are trying to detract or take away chemotherapy for those kids. We're not there yet with the adults. We're still trying to see who we can intensify to try and improve the outcomes.
Just a couple more follow-ups before we kind of get into new agents and new strategies, looking at some of the elements in the pediatric regimens. One is the issue of the asparaginase. Where do we stand today in terms of what we think the value is, the toxicity, and the difference between the different preparations?
The asparaginase has changed a little bit over the last decade or so. We used to use a standard native E. coli-derived asparaginase, which is no longer available in the United States. It has been transitioned to a pegylated form, which has several advantages. One is you can give it intravenously. Kids don't like to get needles. The second thing is it has a much longer half-life, and we think it's more efficacious. It has a little bit more toxicity, but we think it's more efficacious. So in pediatrics, it's clearly replaced all other asparaginase as a standard of care. And in adults, now you have no choice because it's the only thing available. But what we did in our study and what others have done mirroring that is just trying to figure out the dosing schedule in the adult patients. But it is a drug that can be administered. But one of the things that we talked about or that you raised very importantly is, you know, is it the biology or the patient? And as the patient gets older, the ability to tolerate asparaginase therapy becomes less and less. Especially Americans are a little bit bigger on the bigger size. So there is something called fatty liver steatohepatitis, which interferes with asparaginase metabolism. Alcoholism, alcohol abuse, or just chronic alcohol intake can interfere with the metabolism. And there's a lot of other medications that adult patients take, polypharmacy, blood pressure, diabetes, etc., that kids don't. And this all interferes not only with the metabolism, but the toxicity. Having said that, it can still be utilized safely and effectively for the vast majority of younger adult patients. And I still believe in that approach, especially for my patients under age 40.
So can you talk a little bit about where you see some of the biggest needs in the disease and what some of the new strategies and agents are that you see coming along that hopefully will improve these outcomes?
So there's been a luxury of riches lately for acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and that's really an exciting time that we're entering. So chemotherapeutic options, that is new drugs, is really not where the disease is moving. Where the disease is moving is trying to understand more of the biology. I mentioned the Philadelphia-like, understanding who's responding, who's not responding. So we measure response now by detecting whether or not there's a one cancer cell out of 10 to the fourth, which is 10,000. Or 0.01%. So this is minimal residual disease. And we're able to stratify patients who are MRD positive or negative into getting, should they get a transplant, should they not get a transplant. Those changes are huge in terms of really defining how patients go, because you can not transplant a patient who's going to do well, but only transplant those who are going to do well. In terms of newer agents, there's a lot of monoclonal antibodies that are being developed. Blinatumomab is a very ingenious molecule that has, on the one business end, the ability to stick to the tumor cell, CD19, which is expressed almost on all B lymphoblastic leukemia cells. And on the other business end of the molecule, CD3 receptor that can stick on your own T cells, the patient's own T cells. And in so doing, once the length of the linker, not too long, not too short, kind of the Goldilocks phenomenon, was able to stimulate and activate the patient's own immune system, this has been really profound at being able to get patients into remission. And so this led to FDA approval a couple years ago, and then full approval just last month. in relapse refractory patients. And so you asked the question is, what's the future? Well, if you have a drug that works in the relapse refractory setting, moving it up front is really the obvious need. But then there's other monoclonal antibodies. So that's one, that's blinatumomab. Inotuzumab is another agent, more of a traditional antibody drug conjugate, this time against CD22. And so these are two agents that are approved in the relapse refractory setting that are likely to be moved up front, or at least tested up front in earlier settings.
Can you talk a little bit more about inotuzumab and what the clinical research data is right now supporting that agent?
So inotuzumab has been tested, as I mentioned, in the relapse refractory setting, phase 1, phase 2 studies showing that you're able to safely administer it. The nice thing about inotuzumab, it can be administered as a outpatient. It's a simple 2-hour infusion in the clinic. And then what was demonstrated was really exorbitantly high remission rates and very high ability to get patients into what we call an MRD, that is minimal residual disease negative status. And then there was a randomized trial comparing inotuzumab to standard chemotherapy, which showed marked improvement in terms of remission rate in favor of inotuzumab, MRD negative status in favor of inotuzumab, and both event-free and overall survival benefit. So the European authorities have already approved it in Europe. We're waiting for the FDA to adjudicate whether it gets approved in the United States. But apropos of your point before, not only would this be used in the relapse refractory setting, but once it gets approved, there needs to be testing clinical trials to see if we can move it up front.
What toxicities are seen with this agent?
So like with any monoclonal antibody allergic reactions, this particular agent is the antibody component is pretty well tolerated. Allergic reactions are minimal. The calicheamycin, which is the chemotherapeutic that's conjugated to it, can cause some hepatotoxicity as well as low platelets, so delayed recovery in platelets. You don't wait for the platelet count to normalize. You got to reassess the patient and do it early. And then patients who move on to transplant, it can be a little bit complicated with the occurrence of something called veno-occlusive disease, which is a really serious liver problem. Early recognition and changing the type of transplant conditioning regimen is going to be very important. You know, we at our institution have done this for a while and have taken patients through that without a problem. But this is where coordination between the community oncologist who's caring for the patient and the transplant or tertiary referral facility is going to be essential.
So with brentuximab vedotin, the antibody drug conjugate right now that's used in hematologic cancers, you see peripheral neuropathy.
Right.
Do you see that with inotuzumab?
You don't. It's really limited to hepatic and thrombocytopenia and then veno-occlusive disease during transplants. Very rare to see it, although there have been reports. It's very rare to see a single agent inotuzumab causing veno-occlusive disease. It's more often after transplant.
So you talk now about two different agents that are being used in the relapse setting, one approved, one maybe going to be approved. With regard to these two, other than, quote, moving it up front, what are some of the strategies bringing it up front that you're most excited about? How do you bring it up front?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think the way to do it is with clinical trials. So there are clinical trials that are being done. So the cooperative groups funded by the National Cancer Institute, our tax dollars, are already funding both studies. So in adult patients, 40 to 65, initiation of blinatumomab after patients have received induction and consolidation therapy, asking the question, can blinatumomab improve event-free and overall survival? And then we'll start soon. It's already approved by the NCI, is the addition of inotuzumab to a pediatric regimen, asking a very similar question, can inotuzumab improve the outcome even beyond what the pediatric regimens are doing, but can it further improve by getting more patients into a minimal residual disease status, looking at event-free and overall survival improvements? So those studies are already ongoing.
So inotuzumab is combining it, and it sounds like blinatumomab is more like a maintenance?
No, it's a consolidation effort. Blinatumomab is a continuous infusion for 4 weeks, so it's very difficult to add it to chemotherapy. So it's given in a block, so you get a block of induction, a block of consolidation, and then patients are randomized to 2 months of blinatumomab. It's not as bad as it sounds because most of the time the blinatumomab can be administered as an outpatient. You just have a pump, and so patients go around their daily activities. Inotuzumab as well is very similarly, at least in this study, it's given as a block, as a standalone, It doesn't have to be because it's just an antibody like rituximab, or you're talking about brentuximab, other monoclonal antibodies, so it can more easily be combined. The MD Anderson is exploring that, but this particular trial is really adding it as a standalone.
So what about toxicity tolerability with blinatumomab?
So blinatumomab is interesting. It's an agent, again, that is trying to bring your own immune cells to the tumor, in this case, the leukemia. And so what you see is activation of your own immune system. And by activating your immune system, you can see what you would expect. So patients can get fevers, can get chills, can get rigors. We call this cytokine release syndrome, or CRS. And this is important with another new agent called CAR antibodies. But in blinatumomab, you definitely see this. And you see it more in patients with more bulky disease, so the higher your disease burden you see it. It can be easily treated with steroids, dexamethasone, and if it gets severe, you just turn the infusion off. The other toxicity that's very important is neurologic toxicity. These activated T cells, your own activated T cells, in a mysterious kind of fashion, can interfere with your nervous system. And we've seen patients become confused, lethargic. Some patients can have stroke-like symptoms. It's not a stroke, but stroke-like symptoms. We've even seen rare seizures. Again, these can be mitigated with steroids or, in severe cases, just turning it off. Early recognition is the key. Which brings me up to one important point. At least in our center, and we have a big center, we do all our blinatumomab infusions in one portion so that every single one of the nurses has done this over and over and over and over again. Because I work at a hospital which still has house staff and fellows, and they rotate through. So the nurses in this case are much more experienced than the house staff. And they said, no, this is what it is because I've seen this a million times. And so having the nurses empowered, especially with these complicated newer therapies, I think is an approach that really has benefited our institution.
So I recently interviewed David Porter and set my own personal record for interview time of 2 hours and 45 minutes. I'm not going to do that to you today. But, you know, when you were talking about those issues with blinatumomab, obviously it's very similar to what you hear about CAR T.
Absolutely.
So maybe you could condense his work down to 2 or 3 minutes and talk about where we are right now with CAR T and ALL, which sounds like it's about to get approved.
Yes, finally. So, you know, the CAR Ts were really rapidly developed. There was a lot of trepidations and tribulations going over the first generation, second generation, third generation. But we now have a couple products that look like they're likely to get approved this year. In fact, ODAC just voted unanimously to approve the CTL019 component, whatever you want to call it, for pediatric patients. Of course, we don't know exactly what the upper age limit's going to be. Is that pediatric 18 and under, 21 and under, 25 and under? There's likely to be a cap. It's likely to be only in a handful of centers, mostly very large volume pediatric centers. I know that's the way it is going to be in Boston, but this is historic. It's going to be reserved for a third or greater relapse, at least initially, while the toxicity can be played a little bit down. But the pediatric patients who have relapse refractory leukemia, especially third or greater relapse, we haven't seen responses like this ever. And so to be able to get these CAR cells into the hands of multiple patients is just extraordinary. There's going to be more CARs coming down the road, but at least this is the first approval that we expect to see in a few months.
Can you comment a little bit about what's been seen there in terms of cytokine release and also the neurologic syndromes?
Yeah, so this is blinatumomab on steroids, so to speak. It's a logarithmic effect. And so these people can get very sick. And so what we've done is we have a whole team that specializes, and I know we followed a lot of what Porter did at Penn. We have a whole team that specializes just in CAR cells. So they get assigned to a different team. The physician has to be really on 24/7 beeper or access. We have the ICU notified, the neuro ICU notified, because these cytokine release syndromes can happen very, very quickly. And patients can go from being well to being in the ICU quickly. And so it's early recognition and early administration of steroids and another drug called tocilizumab, which can block some of this cytokine-mediated syndrome. The neurologic toxicity also, with really frequent neuro checks and making sure that everybody's on board so that if a patient has any hint of toxicity, you can intervene. but toxicities have been confusion, lethargy, seizure, and even the cerebral edemas that have been very rare, not seen in CTL019, but seen in some other compounds that resulted in death. So we take this very, very seriously. That's why we have an isolated team, group of attendings, nurses that are all specialized in seeing these cases.
I mean, when you talk about early intervention, though, certainly in terms of supportive care, in terms of cytokine release, okay, you have tocilizumab and other supportive steroids, as you mentioned. I take it that that seems like it alters the natural history, but is there anything that alters the natural history of the CNS toxicity?
So that's been very difficult to study. You know, I think, and we're hopeful that by early intervention of the cytokine release syndrome, we'll be able to abrogate some of the later toxicity of the neurotoxicity. But that's not exactly clear, and more work's going to need to be done. We do know that early steroids, when neurotoxicity starts to develop, may be helpful. The tocilizumab may not be as much better for cytokine release than neurotoxicity. So your point is valid. We really don't know what intervention is best. These are rare but very serious events, and so the rarity makes it harder to study and to know what intervention. We've tried to have a blanket approach so that everybody's on the same page with these patients when they're developing or going through their CAR therapy so that we all know what to do and how to intervene. And we also manage them very closely with their ICU colleagues. So if there's any subtle neurologic changes, we move them to a more monitored setting so that, you know, the I's can be dotted, T's can be crossed in terms of the other supportive care management. We think that that also plays a big role.
I am curious, at least in terms of the agents that we've talked up to now, including CAR-T, how this is going to be studied in the earlier setting. But before you tell me how you actually are doing, I'm just kind of curious. Let's face it, intensive chemotherapy is not that easy either.
True.
So, I mean, what do you think you would see? I'm going to just ask a real naive question. If there was randomization of upfront CAR-T versus upfront pediatric intensive therapy?
Well, I mean, that's probably several decades away. I think that, I mean, people are talking about that, and people have been talking about that. And the hope is that CAR-Ts, if used earlier, I mean, it makes sense. You know, the earlier you use a new agent, the better the outcome. Historically, that's been true.
Although this is immune therapy, and I don't know how people's immune systems change with time, but okay.
Yeah, but it's a borrowed immune therapy,
sure.
Right? It's your own T cells that are engineered to attack your tumor cells, and the more resistant your disease is, that means the more times a patient has relapsed and into remission and then relapsed again, that cell has undergone many mutations. And so the earlier you can hit it with whatever, if it's chemotherapy or in this case, immune therapy, the hope is that it's going to have a better outcome. You're right, we don't know that, but that would be the hope. We have a history of showing that that's the case. But it may be that you can imagine initially that CARs are reserved for those patients who would normally go to transplant because they have high-risk disease. And so instead of transplanting a patient, you're giving them a CAR therapy. And then as the toxicity and the comfort level moves up so that people are more able to give the therapies and less likely have complications, I'm just completely hypothesizing here. You can imagine instead of 2 years of therapy with all the complications of chemotherapy, once you get a patient into remission, because immune therapy probably works at a lower disease setting, then if you get CAR therapy after you've done all the maybe one cycle of consolidation, central nervous system, you give CAR and then you're done. You don't have to go through that 2 years of therapy. That's what people have, you know, that's on their Santa wish list. But I think we're still a ways away. Right now, just to be clear, the CARs are going to probably be approved pediatric only, maybe an upper limit of 21 or 25, and third or greater relapse until these issues get worked out.
And where's blinatumomab going to be fitting in?
So blinatumomab, at least in our institution, is still standard of care, first line for relapse refractory. It's the only monoclonal antibody that's approved in that line. Inotuzumab is likely to compete with it. But that's what we use for patients CD19 positive, 95% of all patients with B-cell ALL or 19 positive for patients with relapse disease. And until we see more trials, we're not going to be moving it up. At least myself, I'm pretty rigid in terms of trying to follow the label. I do try to at least encourage patients to participate in clinical trials. There's going to be lots of trials around the country trying to look at blinatumomab and inotuzumab moving farther up on the tree that is earlier and earlier intervention. And as those trials mature, then there'll be a literature that will support its use.
Any other new agents or strategies in ALL that you want to comment on?
I don't want to, you know, take too much time, but I do want to make a couple statements that I think are very important that are difficult to do in the community setting because there's no CLIA certified test. And the two of that is the assessment of minimal residual disease. I just saw a patient last night who was seen for consultation regarding transplant, the patient with ALL, and I really couldn't, you know, the patient's in morphologic remission, but I have no way of knowing whether the patient has MRD negative status or not. And the reference labs, by and large, are just doing immunophenotypic flow, which is looking at bulk disease, not looking at minimal residual disease. In order to do flow minimal residual disease, the pathologist has to look at 1 to 2 million events, and that's just beyond the sophistication of most reference labs. And so, you know, that makes a big decision is whether or not I'm going to send a patient to transplant now or give another couple cycles of chemotherapy or blinatumomab before transplant. So that's the first thing that is important. And then the second thing is identifying those patients who have normal cytogenetics but have this Philadelphia-like signature, for lack of a better term. And again, there's no CLIA certified test, but this is going to be developed to really identify those patients who may have a targetable approach like the Philadelphia chromosome, and we're going to learn more and more of how to treat those patients. So those are the two issues, in addition to the newer drugs, that's going to improve patient outcome.
So I'm going to move on now and talk about AML, and I think you've got a couple of cases here. Maybe we could talk about your 35-year-old man.
Sure. So this is a man who presents very nonspecifically with fatigue, fevers, and chills, and just has this dwindling presentation over a few weeks, and then all of a sudden he gets acutely ill and shows up in the emergency room and has an elevated white count and anemic and thrombocytopenic. And so clearly the money is in the marrow, and the bone marrow is done that shows acute, in this case, acute myeloid leukemia as a reason why this patient became so ill so rapidly. And in a patient with AML, a little bit different than a patient with ALL, the therapy doesn't change that much. Now, with older patients, and depending on what your, it changes as I get older, 65, 70, we tend not to treat those with aggressive chemotherapy, sicker patients clearly. But in young patients like this patient, they're going to get standard therapy. And still 2017, embarrassingly, the chemotherapy regimens that we use were developed in the 1970s, which is daunorubicin or idarubicin. They're interchangeable, plus cytarabine. The new thing that's out is that an identification of a mutation called FLT3 or FLT3 was discovered about 15 years ago to play an important role in predicting relapse, specifically for patients with normal cytogenetics. And these patients behave very poorly. That is, they do get into remission, but they rapidly relapse. And it was shown by multiple studies, mostly in Europe, that stem cell transplantation can improve the outcome. So that quickly evolved into the standard of care. And then just recently, the FDA approved midostaurin, which is the first FLT3 inhibitor to be approved. It doesn't work by itself, interestingly. This is not a drug that works as a single agent, but in combination with standard induction chemotherapy and in combination with standard consolidation chemotherapy, there was a marked improvement in overall survival, really the gold standard endpoint. And that was regardless of whether patients went to transplant or not. So the new standard of care, July 2017, is rapid identification of the FLT3, initiation of standard chemotherapy, and then right after the chemotherapy finishes on day 8 or 9, to start 2 weeks of midostaurin and then get a patient to transplant as soon as possible. If there's a delay, patient gets standard consolidation, again, 2 weeks after the chemotherapy of midostaurin until the patient can be transplanted. That has improved the outcome for this group of patients. 15 years ago, their cure rate was in the 20-25% range, and now we're seeing cure rates of FLT3 positive AML in the 50-55% range. Still more to come, but you know, that's a doubling of the survival in less than a decade.
And of course, we've talked to your colleague Rich Stone a lot about the midostaurin study that he led there and reported at the ASH meeting. Can you talk a little bit more about what, more specifically about what we know about the impact of midostaurin both on the disease as well as the side effects, and how it compares to other FLT3 inhibitors that are being studied, particularly gilteritinib?
Midostaurin is a pan-tyrosine kinase inhibitor. It was initially designed to target a different compound called protein kinase C, but it clearly has broader abilities to inhibit a wide range of tyrosine kinases. And so through the cooperative group and through multiple cooperative groups, there was an ability to really do a first genotypic stratified study. And what I mean by that is patients were enrolled, that is, they signed a consent form. Their blood, their leukemia cells were sequenced in a reference lab within 48 hours. And as I mentioned, only about 1 out of 4 patients are going to have an FLT3 mutation. So you had to screen or cast a wide net on a large number of patients in order to get this 1 in 4 patient population. And physicians and patients had to buy in to the idea that it's okay to wait for the data. When I was in medical school and fellowship, the usual rule of thumb is the sun should not set before chemotherapy starts. That's not true, because these patients did equally well if there was a delay of, 2 to 3 days, just waiting for the chromosomes and the cytogenetics to come back. And then, based on, you've spoken to Dr. Stone, but Dr. Stone did what's called the RATIFY trial, where patients were randomized in the North American group, United States predominantly, but North America, Europe, Asia, to receive standard 3+7 induction chemotherapy for AML with either placebo or midostaurin in a double-blinded fashion, the way that you would want a study done. And it took a long time, because you had to screen 4 patients to get 1 enrolled. And it took a long time because more patients were getting transplanted, transplant outcomes were improving. So the overall survival of both arms were improving with time. But importantly, midostaurin showed not only an event-free survival, an overall survival advantage to the FLT3 patient population. To get to the second question, there's some confusion as to exactly what midostaurin is doing. Clearly, it's inhibiting FLT3 or FLT3. It is a pan-tyrosine kinase, and we looked at patients with a high allele burden, that is, the bulk of their disease were all FLT3 mutant. Those patients had a huge benefit to midostaurin. But importantly, the patients with a low allele burden, that is, patients with a smaller percentage of their leukemia cells being mutated with FLT3, also benefited from midostaurin. So, we don't know if it's inhibiting just specifically through FLT3 or whether there's a larger impact in the non-FLT3 containing cells. That needs to be worked out. Midostaurin by itself is a less potent FLT3 inhibitor, has very limited, if any, single agent activity, only works in combination. And there are more potent FLT3 inhibitors that are in clinical trial development. You mentioned one, gilteritinib. There are others, quizartinib and crenolinib. These are all been through the phase 1, phase 2 settings, all showing, interestingly, single agent activity in deference to midostaurin. And so right now the question is, should those agents be approved? And what's going to happen to the combination? Is a more potent FLT3 inhibitor like gilteritinib or quizartinib or crenolinib going to be superior to midostaurin? And the proof will be in the pudding. Those studies are being planned as we speak.
Any trials out there that we're maybe going to see in the next year or so looking at any of these other agents?
Yeah, absolutely. So those trials are ongoing. So there's a quizartinib versus dealer's choice, if you will. So patients are randomized to quizartinib if they have FLT3 leukemia relapsed in the relapse setting to other multi-agent chemotherapy. That's one. And gilteritinib is undergoing a very similar study, relapse refractory FLT3 positive AML, to get randomized to gilteritinib versus dealer's choice. So you can pick a multitude of different choices of chemotherapy. And then both agents are being combined with standard induction therapy, 3+7, to determine what's the correct dosing and schedule. And then a randomized trial will need to be done. Crenolinib is also being explored in that upfront exact setting. So you'll have 3 different trials, 3 different FLT3 inhibitors, all looking at whether or not they're better or different than midostaurin. So the bar's a little bit higher than it was when Dr. Stone did the RATIFY trial, but I think this is all better for patients.
Any differences between these agents in terms of tolerability, side effects?
That's a little harder to know. The midostaurin clearly has a GI component. That is, there was more nausea and vomiting where for patients who were randomized to the midostaurin arm than not. And the other thing that came through, although very rarely, was rash. So there was a few more rashes. When I mean rarely, I mean it was just single digit. And, quizartinib and gilteritinib haven't been explored in large number of patients in combination. They've only been explored in a single agent predominantly. And they have a very similar signal with a little bit of GI toxicity, that is nausea, vomiting, some diarrhea, but not much else. Very well tolerated by and large.
So I want to ask you about a number of other agents and strategies that I see are being looked at in AML. And you had a really great education session review at ASCO last year that goes through a bunch of those things. But one relates to CPX351, liposomal cytarabine, daunorubicin. What do we know about that, and where do you see that heading?
Yeah, so this is an agent, just to remind those, it turns out that if you administer chemotherapy at a molar ratio, and if you different doses, concentrations, you get different outcomes. What I mean by that is that there are ratios of daunorubicin to cytarabine where the addition of daunorubicin to cytarabine is antagonistic, you get less cell kill, it's additive, or it's synergistic. And it turned out to be this 5-to-1 molar ratio of daunorubicin to cytarabine was synergistic. And so it's fixed in this bilamellar liposome, and it can be easily administered intravenously to patients. What was noted with many phase 1, 2, and now with phase 3 study that was presented by Jeff Lancet at ASCO in 2016 was that the patients who were randomized to the CPX351, they tolerated the drug better. That is, they had less cardiac toxicity. We know that's a problem. They had less oral mucosal toxicity. We know that's a problem. And maybe surprisingly, more patients got into remission, and there was a survival advantage. Now, the patient population is important. These were older patients over age 60 that had secondary AML. And what we mean by secondary AML is these are patients who had a history of myelodysplastic syndrome and then progressed to acute leukemia. And there were some patients who didn't have a history based on clinical outcomes, but their bone marrow had all the characteristics of a secondary AML. That is, they had the cytogenetic abnormalities of myelodysplastic syndrome, and there were a lot of dysplasia in the non-blast cells in the bone marrow. So this is a subgroup of patients that is older with secondary AML. But the outcome in this randomized trial shows superiority, not just in terms of toxicity, but also in terms of survival. And the indication is going to be specifically for secondary AML. Now, if you look hard enough, you can find evidence of secondary AML in a lot of older patients, but I think it may be an issue where cost becomes the driving force. Daunorubicin and cytarabine are generic, very easily administered. The pharmacy costs in the hospital is very limited, very minimal for these two agents, and CPX351 is likely to drive that up significantly. So we have to figure that out. It's going to be a little bit more complex than just saying once it's approved, it'll be used. My personal belief is if it's approved and it's at a reasonable cost, it should be used. I don't know what reasonable is. I'm not an economist.
Well, also the question would be, if you put aside the cost issue completely, if you could, would you want to use it in general, you know, for older patients? Would it allow you to push it up a little higher?
Yeah, I mean, that I completely agree with you. I mean, it was.
Or do you think you need more data?
It was tested in the secondary AML setting. There's no reason why that wouldn't work in de novo presentations, that is, patients who walk in the door over 60 and have a similar outcome. You know, we don't know the answer, but I think the big issue, and we alluded to this earlier in our discussion, with older patients with AML, you're trying to figure out whether they're fit or unfit. And so right now, you only have standard daunorubicin and cytarabine. So the age limit is 70, 75. Most physicians, oncologists, are a little queasy with administering high doses of chemotherapy. But now, if you have CPX351 and you have a 73-year-old, you're going to be much more likely to go ahead, regardless of whether they have secondary or not. So you're absolutely right. What about a 78-year-old who I usually don't treat unless they just ran a marathon last week with standard induction chemotherapy? If I had this agent, I would be more likely to treat. So it may change the algorithm in terms of the upper age. You're absolutely right.
So another thing we've been hearing about, and you covered in your talk at ASCO last year that I think is really fascinating, are the IDH inhibitors, IDH1 and 2. Can you go through that?
Yeah. So again, this is just the power of molecular genetics. Of course, when I was in med school learning about the Krebs cycle and metabolism, had to memorize all these charts and enzymes. I thought I was done and never have to do that again. But clearly, I was wrong. So mutations were discovered by looking at this is the benefit of academic research, investment into the NCI, a little political pitch there. So out of the government funding these whole genome-wide tumor registry exome sequencing, it was turned out that IDH2 was represented and mutated in about 15% of myeloid leukemias and IDH1 in about 7 or 8%. It's a higher mutation rate, for example, in brain tumors where it reaches almost 90%. But sticking with leukemia here, so these are not as common as FLT3, but they're not infrequent either. And what ends up happening with the mutation is it doesn't alter the metabolism per se, but it generates this new molecule, this hydroxyglutarate that is not synthesized with the wild-type enzyme. And this agent, this hydroxyglutarate that we call oncometabolite, goes in and affects the ability to methylate the DNA and has wide genome-wide changes in terms of epigenetics. We don't understand how that works, but it's clear that by affecting the IDH pathway and this molecule that you get the initiation or progression of leukemia. And so what the investigators with endocitinib, which is the first IDH2 inhibitor that's been taken in the clinic, what they've been able to show with single agent, these are relapse refractory patients with acute myeloid leukemia, all who've had an IDH2 mutation, and with single-agent oral medication, they've been able to induce remissions in a little bit over a third of those patients. And many of those remissions have been durable, 6, 12. I've even had a patient that's been durable for 24 months. So, profound single-agent activity. Of course, as per the discussion today, this drug hopefully will get approval, and then it needs to be moved up front. Does this help those patients who are IDH2 mutated who walk in the door and get regular chemotherapy? That's going to need to be decided with more clinical trials. But it's an exciting, exciting age.
I'm getting back to your older patient also. Yeah. Where is that going to fit in the older patient?
Yeah, so, so obviously CPX351 fits in. IDH2 and IDH1 mutations are seen across the board. There's very similar frequency in younger and older patients, so it doesn't matter there. As well as in primary de novo disease and secondary, so it doesn't matter there. And, combination in the fit patient with standard chemotherapy, combination in the unfit patient with what are called hypomethylating agents, azacitidine or decitabine. So these agents are often utilized in older patients. And as I said with CPX351, that age threshold may be changing, but at least right now, for older patients over age 70, we think about the use of these hypomethylating agents. And if a patient has an IDH mutation, why not add one?
And in terms of IDH1, I see one agent, ivosidenib, same story. You see prolonged remissions in some patients?
Same story. Now, it's taken a little bit longer to get that trial through because it's half as frequent as the IDH2. And there are more players, so there are more pharmaceutical companies that have IDH1 inhibitors, but they're all showing very similar activities. That is, about a third of the patients are going into remission, and many of those patients are durable, and some of them are even going into molecular remission.
So another class of agents being looked at in AML, and of course already has become part of CLL treatment, is BCL2 inhibitors, specifically the one that's available as venetoclax. What do we know about this strategy in AML?
So, yeah, I think it's a little surprising. A lot of that stuff was done at our institution showing that AML is a BCL2-dependent tumor. We knew that CLL was from work that was done many, many years ago, but it wasn't clear about AML. And the use of venetoclax has really established that myeloid leukemias are BCL2-dependent. And so the addition of venetoclax in relapse refractory leukemia patients has a single agent activity about 20%. It's not high, but about 20% of patients are able to get in remission. The cute thing is that when you combine it with chemotherapy, in this case with azacitidine or decitabine, you're able to induce remissions in the 70-75% remission rate. These are older patients. We never see remission rates that high in this age group using hypomethylating agents. And the Australian group has been able to combine venetoclax with low-dose Ara-C, again, a drug that has a 10% at highest remission rate and seeing about a 70% remission rate as well. So really profound, high impact on the ability to get patients in remission. Of course, we need more clinical trials and more randomized trials to know what the impact is on the important outcomes, that is event-free survival, overall survival, safety, and tolerability. But I'm very, very excited about the use of these BCL2 inhibitors in myeloid leukemias in general.
And, you know, venetoclax seems to be popping up in places you wouldn't expect. We hear about it in myeloma. We're hearing about it in mantle cell. And actually, I think it was Dr. Kumar mentioned to me, is there some kind of assay available now to look at BCL2 levels?
Well, there's a way you can measure BCL2, but really you can look at, there's a ability to determine whether or not a cell or a tumor cell is primed. What I mean by primed is ready to apoptose. And, you know, so what ends up happening is chemotherapy induces apoptosis, which is programmed cell death. And the addition of BCL2 inhibitors or venetoclax in BCL2-dependent tumors now, it pushes the threshold to almost to the edge of the cliff. So you just need to blow on the cell and they're able to apoptose. And so that's the magic of venetoclax. And you can do some BCL2 profiling or see if they're primed. Dr. Tony Letai and others worked on this correlative science and has been able to reproducibly predict whether a particular patient's tumor cells are going to be sensitive to venetoclax or other chemotherapies per se, just by the presence or absence of whether or not they're primed.
Yeah, we've talked to your colleague Jennifer Brown about venetoclax and CLL, and there, of course, there's a big concern about tumor lysis syndrome. But it sounds like outside of CLL, this is not an issue. So in AML, not an issue?
So, you know, we're still using the same guidelines that were developed in CLL, just out of respect for the patients who were put on those initial trials and had, you know, some really horrendous outcomes because of the rapid dying. Of course, that's exactly what you want in cancer, is rapid cell death. In that case, it was just too rapid, too fast without appropriate monitoring. Now that patients are started on a very judicious and slow ramp up of the drug and are monitored very carefully, this rapid tumor lysis, even in CLL, it can be abrogated and controlled very carefully. We never, ever, ever have seen the same rapid tumor lysis in myeloid leukemias or other leukemias like we do with CLL. There's something peculiar with CLL in terms of the sensitivity to venetoclax.
So continuing on our march through new agents, I kind of miss the days when we could get CME programs funded on basal cell, because I always like to hear about vismodegib and all the weird things that it did. But I see that hedgehog inhibition is being looked at in AML. There's an agent here, glasdegib.
Yes.
What do we know about that?
So glasdegib was tested in a phase 1 trial and then combined with chemotherapy in two fashions. So for the unfit elderly, it was randomized to the addition of low-dose cytarabine. Low-dose cytarabine, similar to the hypomethylating agents, although have fallen out of fashion in the United States, more common in Europe, have about a 10 to 15% remission rate by themselves. And the addition of glasdegib, the smoothin inhibitor or hedgehog inhibitor, dramatically improved the outcome, improved the survival, in fact. So very exciting. That study is now being reduplicated with more modern or more custom therapy, that is the hypomethylating agents, azacitidine or decitabine. And then another part of the same study, but fit patients, were treated with the smoothin inhibitor and standard 3+7. And it was shown to be safe, but it was not a randomized study. So it was just a phase 1-2 study confirming safety, efficacy. And that data was presented in Madrid in June at the European Hematology Association by Jorge Cortez. And so there is a proposed randomized study adding this agent with 3+7 standard induction or in hypomethylating agents like azacitidine in patients who are unfit and older. And so we'll know, based on randomized data, whether or not this improves the outcome for either the fit or the unfit, depending upon the regimen. So very interesting molecule, and very exciting time to have all these drugs really starting to come and pan out.
So I don't know if you've actually used this agent in a trial, but I know with vismodegib, one of the things that always fascinated me were these taste changes that happened. Do you know what happens with this agent?
It's similar, dysgeusia. You see that in standard induction chemotherapy, and it's going to be, you have to see based on the randomized study, what's the differences. Most patients expect it, and their taste buds, you know, for the first couple weeks after they get induction therapy are really wiped out. And so I don't know that it's going to be a huge issue. I was part of the study. I didn't think it was a huge issue. We'll have to see when the randomized study, whether patients agree with that or not.
So next on my list of potential top hits for AML is an old one, gemtuzumab.
Yes, just got voted by ODAC to be approved. So gemtuzumab is a drug that was approved years ago. It's an antibody-drug conjugate. We've talked about those for ALL. It brings calicheamycin to a CD33 target, which is present on about 80, 85% of patients with acute myeloid leukemia. It has some peculiar toxicities in terms of liver toxicity and infusional toxicity, allergic reactions, and also causing veno-occlusive disease. It was tested in a randomized trial in young patients in the United States, and it did not seem to benefit, and then it was pulled off the market. I don't think it should have been, but it was. There were some other studies that were ongoing at the same time in Europe, and they were all positive studies. And so the FDA went back to the pharmaceutical company to ask them to resubmit, and they did. And based on the data from a couple European trials, namely the Alpha done by the French cooperative group, which showed a nice statistically significant benefit in event-free survival, not overall survival, but event-free survival, the drug was voted by ODAC to be approved. And the question, of course, is where we're going to use gemtuzumab. The initial strategy was using this drug as a single agent in very high doses. I think that has too much side effect. And this dosing schedule that the French cooperative group Alpha used, which is more fractionated, lower dosing, showed to be clearly more tolerable, so much less toxicity, and then obviously advantageous. That's what led to a positive vote. So I think that that is going to be established as a potential standard of care for these middle-aged, older adult patients. You know, exactly how that's going to be played out is a little bit less clear than maybe with CPX351 or some of the other targets. But I do see this agent coming back and being utilized. The other disease where we would really love to have it is in some patients with acute promyelocytic leukemia, specifically those patients with a high white count. It's nice not to have to give systemic chemotherapy the way we think of chemotherapy, and gemtuzumab can be administered with all-trans-retinoic acid and arsenic safely and effectively. So there's another indication outside of the AML realm.
Would you do that in your practice if it were available, use it instead of chemo in the higher risk APL?
So we've done that in protocols. We had a Southwest Oncology Group study that added gemtuzumab, very similar to what the MD Anderson published years ago. So for patients with high white count, you need to get the white count down while you're giving the all-trans-retinoic acid and the arsenic, or patients can develop what's called, used to be called ATRA syndrome, but now it's called APL differentiation syndrome. And so we don't have gemtuzumab, so in lieu of it, we give daunorubicin or idarubicin to try and control the counts, but it would be nice to use this agent. When we used it in our cooperative group led by the Southwest Oncology Group, it was very easy to use, and it was very safe and effective. And the MD Anderson group has published numerous publications on that. It's also been used in the European cooperative groups. The MRC, the Medical Research Council out of the UK, have presented and published the addition of gemtuzumab for their high-risk patients with acute promyelocytic leukemia. So, and that's a long-winded answer to yes, but there's much data on the use of this in that particular, not common, risk group.